You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 23. And welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. Tonight, we're hitting the sauce hard, baby. We're drinking, we're stinking, beer, hard liquor, soft liquor, Mike's Hard Lemonade, whiskey. We're boozing it on down here tonight on the Punk News Podcast. We are getting wasted like a frat party. Let me tell you. We're here with the main man, managing editor Adam White, who I believe literally just got back from a drinking. Adam, I've heard you had a taste of a taste, a little nip of the nip. How you feeling?
My original plans for tonight got postponed until next week. So my brother and I sat around and drank beer for the past few hours. So we're recording a podcast.
Now, Punk News has been accused of being a frat house by certain critics. How true be that, do you say?
In terms of age or in terms of gender makeup?
I'm not going to qualify because the criticism was merely that we are a frat house.
Well, okay, so I'm 30-something. I don't know about you, so it would be really fucking creepy if I was in the frat house.
Isn't there a movie like where a bunch of older guys start a frat, though? Is that old school?
Yeah, that's old school.
So, yeah, we could do that, but I don't know. I mean, like, Punk News is always just like a bunch of nerds that have been too lonery to be out there in the real world interacting with people, so we do so on the internet. So I don't really know how frat house that is. Like, if we were more frat house, we'd be, you know, hanging out with more rock stars and name dropping people and I don't know.
And having
and
having our rich dad bail us out of jail.
Yeah, we're just poor lonely people. That's totally different.
And also a master of drinking, master of the keg stand. We are here with copy editor, news editor, reviews editor, Adam Eisenberg. Adam, when's the last time you had a shot of that rough stuff?
I only drink Zima, which is a Sprite-flavored thing.
You don't need to qualify what Zima is for our listeners. They're all well aware.
I don't know. This generation may not appreciate Zima.
Well, that is even more impressive because I believe Zima's been discontinued for like 15 years.
Yeah, that sounds about right, actually.
So I guess you bought a whole bunch of cases of it and have just been milking them, huh?
Yeah, I went to Costco. I have a stockpile in the cellar.
Well, I'm glad Adam Easy on the podcast tonight because we're going to kick off a nice podcast. Well, we got a bunch of mail to read, as always. But before I'm just going to let the kids know what's happening down here in Phil IA. That's Philly. That's how we say it down here, is Phil IA. A couple of nights ago, I saw Open City. That's Rachel Rubino of Bridge and Tunnel, Dan Yemen of Paint It Black, Andy Nelson of Ceremony in Paint It Black and Dark Blue, and Chris Wilson of Ted Leo's band. I saw their new band, and let me tell you, they sound really good. I was really amazed about how good. I mean, I'm a pretty big Paint It Black fan. Not a huge Lifetime fan, not a huge Kid Dynamite fan, but really big Paint It Black fan. And I was pretty sure that Paint It Black was going to be Dan Yemen's best band, and maybe it is, but let me tell you, this band, Open City, with Rachel Rubino on vocals, jumping around, screaming, Dan Yemen kicking out those hard riffs. It's a pretty wild band. I would say it's Fugazi meets Paint It Black with Rubino on vocals. And it is a ripping, raucous, riotous album. I mean, not album, band.
That sounds really good, actually.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I think I've been going to too many hardcore shows, and here's why. I've been going to a lot of house shows and a lot of hardcore. Philadelphia has a lot of house shows anymore, and there's a lot of hardcore bands there, and they're all like pretty good, honestly. They're all pretty good, competent, but so many of them just kind of do the D-beat thing or small variations on the D-beat thing. And I feel like so many of these hardcore bands, if they just put some weird elements into their music, it would make them so special. But instead, they're just another competent, generic D-beat band. I saw the Adam E., are you a fan of this band Blazing Eye?
I'm familiar.
I saw them, and they've got a great, great sound. They're influenced, I guess, by Japanese crust, if you know what that is, like Jism or Zao, D-beat, and almost kind of like, I want to say like Samhain, kind of like dark Halloween-y type sounds. And they sound great, but kind of all the songs kind of have that same sound. I really think that hardcore bands should really start getting more risky. You know, have a couple of standard hardcore songs, but then put in some whacked out stuff too. I mean, do you guys agree? I mean, I feel I'm in danger of burning myself out on hardcore because so many of these bands just do competent hardcore that could have been written in 1988. You know what I'm saying?
We both went at the same time. And now we've created this impasse. I'm just going to go first because I have seniority. No, I mean, I entirely agree with you. That's partly the reason why I've never seriously gotten into hardcore is because whenever I think that I'm going to, I sort of really quickly end up on that, you know, this all kind of sounds the same wavelength. But, and that's, it's a little bit unfair to look at the internet or to look at this like from our perspective where we're just like, you know, how much hardcore can we find on the internet, right? And take that perspective for it. Because if you're in your local scene and that is your local band that is doing that thing, it's really awesome. So it's just sort of like when you pull back a little bit and go like, okay, amongst like all the music that I could potentially consume is, you know, is this the most interesting? The answer is usually no. But, you know, when I'm at a local show and local hardcore band is on, it's great. So, I don't know. Also, you said Samhain. I'm super disappointed in you.
Oh, I should say Shawan?
Yeah, well, like, but dramatically.
Shawan.
There you go.
Oh, I should say, like, Samhain. Or Samhain!
Well, yeah, Dancing! Anything.
Shawan. Well, because I'm really, I mean, like, this band, and I'm not talking trash on this band, Blazing Eye, because I like them so much that I bought their 7-inch, their cassette. But they're on the verge of being special, as opposed to just being cool. You know what I mean? I want them to be special. Adam E., comment.
There's a ton of hardcore out there. That's absolutely true. And I think I listen to kind of a lot of it. But I, at the same time, I feel like I'm kind of picky. Like there is a lot of stuff that is not that interesting. And then there's some stuff that's really interesting. And I there is really good stuff out there if you wade through some of the more generic stuff.
I'm worried about, see, I've been buying hardcore demo cassettes right and left, and I've got a problem. I can't stop. I'm like, it's only $3. Let me check it out. I'm scared that I'll burn myself out on hardcore entirely because all these bands kind of do like the same hardcore bass with a minor deviation on top of that. I only want to listen to the cream of the crop because I don't want it to ever become root for me. You know what I'm saying?
I also find with those demos a lot, it's like that demo cassette is like the very first stuff they're doing. It's real rough. And a lot of times the demo cassette's kind of lame. And then you get that 7-inch that comes after and it's like, oh, they took this somewhere.
But isn't the old cliche like, oh, they were better on the demo? Like, isn't that the thing?
Yeah, but that's just a cliche.
The cliche is that they're better on their first album than their third. It wasn't necessarily that they're better on their first shitty cassette.
Well, there you have it. I have been thrashed for my stance on hardcore. But we've got lots of mail this week. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. This first one is from Jeff. I just wanted to write a little thank you to Adam White for bringing up these two bands on the podcast, the Dirty Nil and Single Mothers. And including them on his end-of-year list. I live in Washington, D.C., and maybe wouldn't have heard of them otherwise. I just caught them this past Thursday at the Black Cat in D.C., and both put on an absolutely amazing show, and the Dirty Nil were super nice guys. I didn't talk to anyone in Single Mothers, so I can't say. Keep up the good work. Being all grown up and out of the loop, I realized a couple years ago that the most recent release I had on regular rotation was from 2004, so I've started paying attention to the new bands you guys bring up on the show, and it's revitalized my appreciation and love for good punk rock. Thanks from Jeff.
Holy shit, that makes me feel really good.
And then some more mail. We got a long letter. I think I'll read the whole thing because it's well written. This is from Brendan. Here's Brendan. He says, "Hey guys, just wanted to say I'm a longtime listener of the podcast and really dig the perspective you gentlemen have on what's trending in the punk rock world. That being said, in the interest of promoting one of the best punk festivals in the world, I thought I'd accept your invitation to write in. I went for the first time last year to Amnesia Rock Fest, and the best way I can describe it is Warped Tour for adults. Given the lineup is geared heavily towards older acts, the average age at this thing would be late 20s or early 30s, and it's a great time. Most attendees camp out at a massive campsite near the festival grounds, and it's essentially a huge weekend party within the small town of Montebello. While I agree that the lineup is a bit of a mess with everything from Reset to Slayer to Simple Plan, it's a festival I can lure my friends to that has The Offspring in Linkin Park and trick them into seeing Bad Religion or The Descendants. There are 5 stages, I believe, and unfortunately, yes, there are bound to be conflicts, but there are 2 sets of stages next to each other and 1 off on its own, so there's only a maximum of 3 bands playing at the same time. So thankfully, I managed to see almost everyone I want year after year. Big picture, the event is a blast. Everyone is super friendly. There's camping, parties, bartenders who literally will walk into the pit to serve you a beer, and I'd highly recommend it. I'm from Toronto, and it's definitely worth a 6-hour drive. Also, as a Torontonian, thanks for keeping it real by promoting Canadian bands, Adam. On that topic, I'd like to get your thoughts on bands like Pup and the Dirty Nil playing Warped Tour this year. Good for them, or is it bound to lose? Or are they bound to lose org core credibility? Thanks again, Brendan."
This is the best set of letters we've ever had, because they're all about me. Okay, the Pup is on like a fucking rocket ship to the moon right now. So yeah, they're good. They're going to play Warped Tour and then bigger festivals than that, and they're going to get super huge, and everyone's going to love them, and they deserve it, and that's cool. I can deal with that.
And you were there first, Adam. You were there first.
No, I wasn't there first. I mean, okay. I saw them when they were Topanga, and they were just playing little places at the.
Was their demo tape better?
Actually, it's funny because like even though I saw them back when they were not Pup, I totally didn't pay attention to them until they were. So, you know, I've just pissed away my cred there. But the nil is weird though, because the Dirty Nil is one of these bands that to me is a pet band of mine that I'm uneasy when there's change or when anything is happening to them that falls outside of like them playing my local venue again. Like, so much so that, like, the bass player shaved his amazing mustache off, and I've been a little bit, like, nose at a joint about it for the past several months. Like, that mustache was part of that band's act. It was a Freddie Mercury mustache, John. And without it, I don't know what to believe anymore. So Dave Nardi, bass player for the Dirty Nil, you've shaken my belief system by shaving your mustache, and I don't know what to do. But, I mean, it's interesting seeing them playing that. I mean, on the one hand, you know, that's really cool. I'm looking to, you know, we're all still kind of waiting to find out what this band's release will be, because they still keep putting out, like, tiny little things. And, like, yeah, they put out a 7-inch on Fat, but, you know, the band has, like, an album worth of material they've been playing and releasing as their own little things, and they're pretty committed to doing short-form releases, and I'm cool with that. But at some point, you know, as popularity grows or whatever, the band is going to go record a record, and that will be interesting, because there's very, very few bands I think I've been into this much before they've had a full length out, at least in recent memory. So it's going to be interesting to see how I can handle that and any potential changes that are surely to come. But yeah, I mean, hey, I don't think the Warped Tour is, especially for, you know, for actual punk rock bands, I don't think playing the Warped Tour means what it meant, you know, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, it was a potential springboard to, you know, you being one of these bigger pop punk acts. But today, I don't even like the headliners that play the Warped Tour, I don't even know anymore. So I can't imagine that there's a huge crossover between people going to see, I don't know what the fuck, like Falling in Reverse, and you know, someone going to, I'm sure, one of the side stages to watch the Dirty Nil play. I don't know if, like, that's going to catapult Nil to any particular stardom or anything like that. So, you know, I'm pretty sure Warped Tour is pretty safe right now. It's not, doesn't have this, you know, potentially bad cross-pollination thing that maybe it did. Or maybe it didn't. Maybe we just all made that up because we were all super self-conscious about punk rock breaking in the mainstream. I don't know, but I'm not worried about it. It's cool for them. It's good for them. Well, they should grow their mustaches, though.
There you have it. Adam White says, A-OK for Pup and the Dirty Nil playing Warped Tour. This one's from Ireland. This is from Sanburn in Ireland. He says, hello, mates. Been listening to the podcast since it started. I live out here in Castlevar in Ireland, and there isn't much of a punk scene, so the podcast is a great way to stay connected. I've been holding on to this one since the last time Adam E was on. Sandberg continues, I really like Adam E. John G. screams too much, and Adam White's tastes are too refined for a bloke like myself. Just kidding, mostly. Adam E. is always thoughtful and articulate. Adam E., I'm coming out to Fest this year. What venues should I check out? Keep up the podcast and makes my walk to work bearable. From Sandburn.
I'm flattered.
What venue should he check out?
Well,
actually, you know, Adam E. Being a tastemaker all the way out there in Castlevar, Ireland. Mm.
I'm big in Ireland. So the interesting thing about Fest this year is last year, for the first time, they had this big outdoor venue where the Descendants played, and it got kind of mixed reviews, although I thought it was all right. It was a way to have bigger bands than they were able to have before. But from what I understand, the city of Gainesville has temporarily closed that big outdoor thing for like a year to refurbish it and do all sorts of stuff. So that is seemingly going away, at least for this year. So in terms of the size of the bands they were able to get last year, like the Descendants, which I think Tony said in an interview a few years ago, he wanted to get them, but he needed this bigger venue to get it. Losing this bigger venue is kind of interesting because I don't know what they'll do about bigger bands. But in terms of smaller places, like Dirty Nelly's is a really cool little like Irish bar kind of place with a little stage in the corner where some of the smaller bands play. That place can get pretty packed and sweaty, and I've seen people like swinging from the fans during the sets. 1982 is also cool. It's like a little tiny bar with not really a stage, but a kind of a floor, and you can play Nintendo there.
Ooh.
Which is always nice. So those two, you know, beyond where the big bands play, those two are good ones to check out.
Adam, are you a Fest like maniac? How many times have you been to Fest?
My first one was 7, and I've been to every one since, and this next one this year is 14.
That's a lot, man.
Yeah. But I just drive there, so I don't have to like pay for a plane and all that. It's like 5 hours away from where I live.
Are you gonna make it this year?
I don't see why not.
Oh, nice. All right. Well, Adam E. will be on the ground reporting from Fest Live this year. Last email, this is from Greg. And if you remember, I think it was either probably two or three podcasts ago, we got an extended conversation on why is Falling in Reverse on Epitaph. Is that Mr. Greg, you know, just making money any way he can so he can support smaller bands? Does he actually like that kind of music? What basically, can we solve the puzzle of Falling in Reverse on Epitaph? And if you don't know, Falling in Reverse is a really terrible band. You know, they're sexist, they're misogynist, and the music is just really bad. It's kind of like screamo pop, I guess. It's just really bad music. And so here's what Greg had to say. Hey, guys. I'm a long-time listener of the podcast and a big fan of the site. Thanks, Greg. I just finished listening to the most recent episode, 237, where you discussed the new Falling in Reverse record, and I just wanted to weigh in. I don't get down on Epitaph for signing larger, maybe less interesting bands if it means they can fund records by less well-known artists. But in my opinion, Falling in Reverse is an absolute disgrace. Falling in Reverse has consistently proven themselves to be sexist, misogynist bigots, and they have no place on Epitaph. To me, punk rock is about creating communities and modes of thinking that help destroy oppressive systems. By putting out Falling in Reverse, Mr. Brett is implicit in hierarchical systems of sexism. I don't have a beef with the guy for wanting to turn a profit. I do have a problem with someone who thinks it's okay to put out this garbage if it means he can also put out the new Retox album from Greg. So Greg's taking a firm stance, but honestly, I'm not sure that I disagree with him, to tell you the truth.
I don't disagree with him. One of the most problematic things is that it's not necessarily that Epitaph is releasing shitty bands. It is that Epitaph is releasing shitty bands that are saying and doing some shitty things. And that's harder to square than when it was, when we could just say that, like, oh, hey, that's what sells, right?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, it would be less of a sin, if you will, if Epitaph put out like a Backstreet Boys record than Falling in Reverse. And I think that's because Falling in Reverse goes against so many values that punk rock, aside from like Gigi Allen, holds sacred, if you will. I don't know. Anyway, that's it. Thanks for writing in, Sandburn, Greg, Brendan, and Jeff. Thanks for writing in. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. I think let's play a tune and come back and hit him with some news, fellas. And that'll give us time to take some more shots, drink a few more brewskis, and keep this frat party rocking. Do some keg stands.
The fact that I admitted that I had had a few beers before we have done this, you've blown completely out of proportion.
That's what I do, Adam. I blow things out of proportion. That's pretty much my job. That's the fundamental element I am at Punk News, is creating storms out of teacups, if you will.
Well, then play a song, John.
Oh, you want me to play a song? All right, I'll play a song. All right, let's see. Oh, I know what I'll play. I'm going to play – this is a super interesting track. A little while ago, Darbin, baby. Love the Dollar Bin. So many cool record collectors. So many record collectors like, oh, I only went the most pristine vinyl. I don't go through the Dollar Bin. Shh, you got to go through the Dollar Bin. The Dollar Bin is where it is at. I love the Dollar Bin. I came across a record by Pete Shelley. Adam, who is Pete Shelley?
Pete Shelley from the Buzzcocks, John?
Yes, indeed. Pete Shelley from the Buzzcocks put out a solo record, and I got this record once. And I took it home, and it was not what I expected at all. It's like an electro kind of 80s dance record. But the more I listened to it, the more of a David Bowie influence I heard on it. And I hated it at first. And then I was at this club, and I heard them playing it at the club, and it hit just because it was so loud and so booming. So it doesn't sound like the Buzzcocks, but I guess it does sound like the Buzzcocks if the Buzzcocks were all electronic. And it's a pretty wild record. It's called Homo Sapien. This is the opening track, and it's a sound that I would not expect Pete Shelley to make. But this record is cool. It's different. It's a different sound. It's a daring sound, but it's cool. This is Homo Sapien from Pete Shelley's first solo record called Homo Sapien.
Thomas.
And we are back on the Punk News Podcast. Ooh! And actually, well, I'm not trying to make this the John podcast, but we'll talk about this, and then I'll pull back for the rest of the podcast. We did something really, really cool, in my opinion, on Punk News this past week. If you've been following the podcast, you know that a while ago I found a record at the record store. We probably should play this track by The Flames now that I think about it, instead of Pete Shelley. Oh, well. We found a track. I found this record at the record store. It was by this band called The Flames. No information about it anywhere on the internet anywhere, which is really rare for a punk record. Well, on the back of the record, in magic marker, was the name of one of the guys in the band, Michael J. Richards, and a telephone number. And if you remember, we actually called that number live on the podcast, and we just got like an answering machine, so we left a message. Lo and behold, 6 weeks later, I get an email from Michael J. Richards. And it turns out, and I got to interview him through this, and it turns out that the record was never released. He basically put all his heart and soul into this record, and it just no record label would pick it up. So for the first time ever, we streamed this record at Punk News along with an interview with Michael Richards talking about the history of the record. So this was super thrilling for me, and for me this is what record collecting is all about, is we found this rare obscure record that had never been released. Contacted the guy that recorded it. He was so happy to talk about it because the public had never heard this record, and for the first time ever we streamed this previously unreleased record on Punk News. And I'm pretty sure this is the first time we've ever streamed both an archival release as well as an unreleased record on Punk News. And I gotta say, the kids more or less seemed to dig it, which really got me excited. And I was really thrilled that Michael was happy with how this all went down.
Yeah, have you heard from Michael after the article ran?
I have. I don't want to pat myself on the back, but maybe I'll read the email from him about it. So let me pull this email up real quick. And then here we go. So, like I don't want to pat myself on the back, but it's just so cool how this thing played out. I mean, the likely reaction is that like nothing happened at all. Like we never heard back from him, but we did. And here's what Michael said. And then here we go. I just got home from work at around 9 p.m. Mountain Time. Deanne, that's his wife. Deanne had called me at work about your presentation. She was very excited and said I would love it. John, I absolutely love what you have done. I am deeply, deeply moved and feel very happy. Your article is great. I love it. Deanne says you are a great writer, and I agree. Basically, I'm just blown away by the whole presentation. You put your heart and soul into it. It's just beautiful. The music sounds great. You made it sound exactly right, clean and punchy. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I really, really love what you've done. Deanne and I are really touched by the love and care that you all put into this.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, that's cool, isn't it?
I think, John, you deserve some kudos for doing this. This was clearly not, you know, a lot of the times, I don't know, with Punk News, we get accused for, I don't know, for whatever reason, of, I don't know, playing stuff that is meant to attract the kids or anything like that. Or I don't even understand half the criticisms we've got over the years. But this is clearly outside, you know, like Universal Records did not hand us a check to, you know, do an in-depth article about The Flames. So that's, you know, that's really cool. And it's good that you've done that. Do you want to play something from this?
Yeah, I think we should. We should, yeah, yeah.
What do you want to play?
Well, my favorite song is You Always Survive, but we already played that one on the
podcast. Play Living in Bondage.
Living in Bondage. Should we just play it right now?
Yeah, why not?
Let's do it. This
is our show. We can do whatever we want.
Living in Bondage by The Flames. And you can hear the whole, you can hear the whole record for the first time ever right here on Punk News. Do it all, submit control.
Jacksonville.
Back, that was Living in Bondage by the Flames, and if you want to get the full Flames saga, you got to go back through the Punk News podcast archives, because whatever, all the story happened there first, but you can get the recap of it out on Punk News right now. So let's talk about some of the news that happened this past week, and chat about a few things that are going on here. So the first thing here is that Laura Jane Grace of Against Me has announced an elaborately titled tour, which is called "Killing Me Loudly: An Evening of Existential Dread, Fiending, and Gender Dysphoria in the Brilliance of Life's Headlights." So that is the name of her solo tour. The shows are going to feature Grace along with a few surprise guests and spoken word performances, and they've been announced so far for Los Angeles, Las Vegas, New York, Manchester, Tennessee. Is that Tennessee? Help me with your states,
Tennessee,
Americans.
Tennessee.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, Bonnaroo is a huge festival.
Oh fuck! I didn't even look at the venue. I was just looking at the city. Anyways, yeah, Bonnaroo. Brooklyn and in Oregon. So there is a whole bunch of stuff that's. Oh no! Wait, sorry. No, sorry. I'm gonna back right up here. I should read before I actually say things. Laura Jane's solo show is just Los Angeles, Las Vegas, New York. Those next three dates: Manchester, Brooklyn, Oregon. Those are full Against Me sets. So. Keep that in mind. But anyways, yes, Laura Jane is doing more solo stuff. Any thoughts on what this is going to sound like? Like, because she did the whole True Trans tour before the record came out, when they just had the EP that they were promoting, and so she did kind of the solo rounds at that point. So I assume this is kind of a similar deal, but this sounds more like a put together kind of arts performance.
Well, I had read, I think this was mentioned by people who saw some previous solo shows she did in the comments on this story, that some of the more recent solo shows she's played against me stuff and, you know, her own stuff chronologically with like stories in between it. So it sounds like this might be going more in that direction of something, you know, yeah, more structured.
Oh yeah. So there you go. That's the upcoming, Laura Jane, solo tour. So you guys check that out. Speaking of tours, Modern Life is War is headed out for the a tour which is the anniversary of their 2005 sophomore album Witness. So the band is planning a reissue of that record and a series of full album shows to promote the 10th anniversary of that record. It's been remastered by Brad Boatwright at Audio Siege. It also features a whole bunch of, you know, nice reissue features like redesigned packaging for the CD and vinyl. The vinyl version is coming with deluxe gatefold jacket, which includes a 12x12-inch 28-page booklet. And both formats include additional liner notes from listeners worldwide. The whole thing, that whole Modern Life is War thing, is due out on June 2nd. So that's where you guys can check that out. If you want to find the tour dates, they're on Punk News right now. The band is starting out in... they're playing in Europe this month, this April. What is today?
Today's April 9.
April 9. So they're playing tonight.
Tonight?
In London, England. So if you're listening to the show in 6 weeks when we post this podcast, then you are screwed. But they're going to be over playing in Europe until the 18th. They're back into the U.S. on May 23rd to play Bloodfest. And then they have this set of Witness shows that they're doing starting on June 5th in Boston and then playing them in New York, Philly, Berkeley, California, Los Angeles, Anaheim, Minneapolis, Des Moines, and St. Louis. Is that St. Louis?
St. Louis, yeah. St. Louis, St. Louis.
See, I wanted to say that, like, oh, I'm looking at... See, why am I fucking up all of your U.S. states right now? I'm looking at this and I'm thinking that, like, oh, St. Louis and St. Louis are two different places. Anyways.
I believe it's St. Louis, Missouri, but people call it St. Louis.
Anyways, you know, it's weird. I'm going to diverge right from this story. My parents, when they were growing up, and this shows you how your standing in the world has diminished in America. When my parents grew up, and so they were in, like, Canadian, you know, grade schools... One of the things that you had to do is memorize like U.S. state capitals and stuff like that. And it was just, and no one questioned that like that was part of the curriculum because, you know, of course, why wouldn't you memorize U.S. state capitals? It's the United States. They're the center of the world. When I was in school, there was nary a mention of your filthy nation, regardless of its capitals or states or anything like that. So every once in a while. Especially after I've been drinking, I will get to one of these things and be like, oh, fuck, which one is this? So anyways.
I'm sorry Canada's not interested in interacting with the world economy, Adam, because we had to learn the territories in America, grade school. So I'm sorry you guys aren't interested in multiculturalism.
I don't know. I think in most American grade schools now, they probably don't even teach the American kids the U.S. capitals.
Yeah, you know, they don't even teach cursive anymore. That's like so
it's
dumb.
It's a sad state of affairs.
Yeah, it is a sad state of affairs.
This is when we go, thanks, Obama, because that's the joke.
Thanks, Obama. Hey, let's talk about something that's not a sad state of affairs. One of Adam White's, his favorite newer bands, who I believe he called one of the 15 bands to check out in 2015, they've released a new track. The band, Dilly Dally. And they're from Toronto, which is not in the U.S., which is in Canada.
Yep.
And they've got capital, too. They've got a track called Gender Role. It's off the Candy Mountain 7-inch from this past October.
No, not off the Candy Mountain 7-inch.
Oh, it's not?
Follows that.
Well, see, I never learned cursive, so I can't read this. So anyway, they've got a brand new track. It's called Gender Role. Adam White, do you dig this? Is this where your head's at these days?
You know what? My head is at wherever the Buzz Records family of bands seems to be going these days. So, Dilly Dally among them. If you haven't listened to this band, we played them on the show before. They play. It is a female fronted four piece. It is really the sort of like the artistic voice of vocalist Katie Monks, and then she has some great people that are playing in the band with her. But it's really her kind of personality that dominates it, and it's grungy and it's slurred and it's emotional and it's freaks out every once in a while, and it's it's what I want from a lot of my punk rock right now, which is for it to just be like a little bit unhinged and a little bit weird and a little bit dangerous. So that's what Dilly Dally is like a lot of the time. So so this is this band has still only really released one physical thing, as far as I understand it, which is which was the Candy Mountain 7-inch that came out on Fat Possum last year. So at some point, there is a proper EP or LP coming from this band, and they keep like throwing music onto SoundCloud or wherever, you know, in the lead up to it. So this is another one of those. So who knows when you'll actually be able to get this thing? But yeah, there you go. Because I'm into promoting this band because I like them so much, I'm going to play a Dilly Dally song. I'm not going to play this song though, only because I think this is a situation where they released it for a, you know, exclusive premiere on some website that's not ours. And I think that playing it on our podcast might not necessarily be kosher. So I'm going to play an earlier song from them. This song is called Next Gold. It's another one of these ones that I just kind of thrown online that hasn't had a physical release to my knowledge, but it's really cool. So this is a Dilly Dally track. It's called Next Gold. They're from Toronto. Check it out.
A little bit of a sad story, unfortunately. If you've been following the Gwar saga, it's been a rough couple of years for Gwar. As you know, Corey Smoot, the guitarist who kind of revitalized the band, died about 3 years ago, I guess now. And as you know, just about exactly a year, well, not exactly a year ago, but very close to a year ago, Dave Brocky, basically the founder, the director, and Otis Rungus of Gwar, died of a heroin overdose. It was very sad. I mean, it really was sad. Well, now, and actually, if you remember, the band actually had a Viking funeral for Otis Urungus and Dave Brocky, and Jello was there, and Tesco V was there, and a lot of people were there, basically to pay respects to Dave Brocky and this great universe of Gwar that he created. Well, unfortunately, Gwar is being sued by Dave Brocky's father, who's called William Brocky. Basically, William Brocky is claiming that the band stole Dave Brocky's cremated remains, his bass guitar, a gold record, that the band did not pay to William Brocky, Dave Brocky's share of the final tour receipts, Dave Brocky's share of the band, and as well as Dave Brocky's artwork. William Brocky's asking for $1 million in compensatory damages plus punitive damages for breach of contract, unauthorized use of Dave Brocky's image, and he wants the stuff back. He claims that a small fraction of Dave Brocky's ashes were delivered in a plastic bag with a Discover credit card logo in it. The band responded, and basically the band said this is all completely untrue. They said that they disposed of Dave Brocky's ashes as per Dave Brocky's wishes. They said that all the things that Dave Brocky's father said was not delivered to him actually was delivered to his lawyer already before the filing of this lawsuit. And they also said that all payments due to Dave Brocky were paid to the Dave Brocky estate, and they have the records to prove it. I mean, going off the social media, a lot of the Gwar guys have social media. It seemed that they did seem really, really hurt by this. And I've got a lot to talk about here, at least something to talk about. But I'll let you guys throw this out to you guys first. What do you think's going on here? Do you think Gwar's acting maliciously? What do you think's going on?
The problem here is that this comes down to I don't want to say an accusation, but it comes down to like something that is completely out of the public eye, so that we can't actually make any judgment on it. Which is the band says they delivered, you know, these items to the lawyer, so they either did or they didn't. Like there's no matter of opinion from us that's going to change that part. So like, to me, that's the oddest thing about this story. It's not merely that that Dave's father thinks that there's been a certain amount of disrespect, or Dave's father thinks they've been doing things in his name that they shouldn't. Like, I could at least understand that, like, you know, in the pain of losing a son and seeing his, and the fact that he was a public figure, and seeing how that his public image has been, you know, taken and manipulated since his death. Like, I could get the conflict there, but the fact that this comes down to well, the father says he didn't get X, Y, and Z, and the band says they gave that to the lawyer. Well, then at that point, I'm like, well, what's the truth? Because that's outside of opinion, or it's outside of, like, you know, is this respectful or not? And that's just like plain, like, did this happen or did this not? And that's what's weird. It's weird to me that this blew up in public with that part of it unresolved.
Well, to be fair, and I guess Punk News played a part. I mean, Punk News didn't post this originally. What happened with many celebrities is TMZ didn't post this, but a TMZ-type website have people that hang out at the courthouse and just read the public filings. And if somebody's famous, then they call up TMZ and say, hey, TMZ, I've got a story I'll sell to you for $500 about this celebrity, and they buy it. So no one made this public except for TMZ-type websites, you know, and then it blew up all over the internet. You understand what I'm saying?
There's people that do that?
Yes, there are, absolutely.
This is why we don't memorize your states.
Go down to L.A. courthouse. They actually, like, hang out there, and sometimes the guards have to ask them to leave because there's too many of them hanging out.
Oh, I was on a high, and then you've just knocked my faith in humanity down a little bit.
Adam, do you have any insight with regards to this?
What, with regards to the practice of people doing that?
Well, with anything. I mean, this is the Punk News podcast.
Yeah, I mean, with regard to people doing that, yes, they do it. But I mean,
Adam, you work at a newspaper. Does your newspaper do that?
No, we do not, and most newspapers do not. It's like the TMZ type websites that do it, and some TV. Not usually like your TV network stations or anything like that, but there are TV shows that'll pay also. And that's the difference. And yeah, they send people to do all sorts of weird things like that just to kind of get ahead. And, you know, then there's all sorts of, you know, it's essentially like paparazzi types. Instead of taking pictures, though, they're reading the filings.
So let me shed some insight into the Gwar story. Basically, Gwar fans, and it seems like most of public as a whole, are saying Dave Brocky's father, William Brocky, is just being a jerk. And I'm inclined to go towards that, but it's not clearly black and white. And this is not outside of school. Dave Brocky actually has some pretty extensive memoirs that he posted online in the 3 years preceding his death. And I actually want to cut and copy and paste them all before it goes away, just because there's no one there to maintain his website. But basically, Dave Brocky did not come from a really happy family situation. He was actually born in Ireland, but he was adopted by Canadians when he was a baby. So this is really his adopted father. Dave Brocky's Well, according to Dave Brocky's memoirs, his dad was not a nice guy. Maybe was abusive either verbally or emotionally or physically. He wasn't exactly clear, but neither his mom nor him or his brother got along with his father. And I guess what made it worse, or however you want to – I don't know if that – well, his brother was a homosexual. And Dave talked about how he was so proud that when his brother came back from college, he was a lot more, I guess, like flamboyant. And I don't mean that – I don't mean that disparagingly. I mean, like, you know, like RuPaul's flamboyant. You know what I mean? And so, like, the dad didn't react well to that at all. The brother eventually died of AIDS, and I think his dad didn't come visit him at all. And then his mom died, I think, a while ago. Actually, I think his mom died fairly early, too. And so Dave Brocky did not get along with his father. I don't think his father ever saw Gwar live. And I don't even think they really spoke. I think they might have spoke a little bit, but they didn't speak too much. And this is all in the memoirs. I'm not like some inside source or whatever. And so Dave Brocky and his father did not get along, you know. And so the band and the public as a whole was saying, well, he didn't even like care about his son or like his son, so he's just trying to get money. I don't think it's exactly that. I do have some sympathy for William Brocky, even if what these memoirs or whatever are entirely accurate. I mean, the guy saw his both his sons die before him, and he saw his wife die before him. That's horrible. You know what I mean? That's absolutely horrible. I mean, it's terrible to see your wife die before you, but your two sons, young, it's absolutely horrible. And I suspect, and this is just, now this is purely my conjecturing, is I think his dad is probably not straight-laced, but a conservative kind of guy who's not into all this wild art stuff like Gwar. And so I think maybe his dad kind of blames the band, even though most of the guys in the band joined the band long after Brocky started it. I think he blames the concept of the band for leading to his son's demise, you know, the wild partying and that kind of stuff. So I think he's just angry that you know, both his sons died before him. And also, and I was really amazed by this, is at the Dave Brocky public funeral, it really was like a party. It wasn't like a funeral. Like, people were drinking and cursing and like eating barbecue at like his wake, the public wake. I don't know about the private wake. And so I thought that was lacking in decorum. But on the other hand, maybe for Dave Brocky, that's perfect. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I can't decide whether someone else's funeral is proper. You know what I mean? You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I think maybe Dave Brocky's dad might have saw that and said, how can they bury my son like this, you know, drinking and cursing and eating barbecue? You know, it's somebody's death. It's not a laughing matter. So if I had to get – and the dad didn't go to any of the funerals, mind you. So if I had to guess, I don't think the dad is being sinister, like saying, oh, let me get some money out of this. I think he's finding himself at the end of his life in a very sad situation, and is just reacting out of anger towards the world. That being said, it's not necessarily right for him to sue Gwar, but I understand where the father is coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I don't.
How's that for heavy conversation?
Yeah, I don't know where to go with that. You've taken this well, to its extreme. I mean, again, there's so much of this that we on the side don't really know too much about that it's hard to. I don't know. It's hard to pick a side in this. It's just
– well, I side with Gwar because, I mean, does the dad really need to be suing for $1 million? What's that going to get him? You know, his son's dead. What's $1 million? It's nothing. You know what I mean? But I think he's just angry, you know. So I side with Gwar, but I understand the father's pain.
I think that's it. I mean, like, yeah, like, I don't know. $1 million doesn't seem to have any connection to reality. But you know, I don't want to talk too much shit about a grieving father, you know?
Well, exactly. Let's talk about someone people love talking shit about, even though I have sympathy for this guy too. Morrissey. He released a new I'm going to bum you guys out on this one too, but I'll let you guys go first. Morrissey, he's back with a new music video. The music video is for Kiss Me A Lot, which is off the last year's album, World Peace Is None Of Your Business, which the critics savaged, but I think it's his second best album. Morrissey has also announced a new North American tour following his last one, which was canceled due to a virus, following his last two, both which were canceled. I think in the Bay Area and Chicago, I think Morrissey has canceled his last five shows in a row, which, I mean, that's a record, you know? Did you guys watch this video? Are you guys on the Morrissey hate train?
I did watch this video, and I do not care for Morrissey. at all. And this video just further confirmed that. But actually, on his last tour, he did play Miami, and he actually did go through with it.
My life is measurably better for having watched this video. It's what makes Morrissey such a fascinating person at this point is that for such like an insufferable hard ass, he then releases like a video like this where it's, he cannot be unaware of how ridiculous this is. Like,
explain to them why it's ridiculous if they haven't seen it.
Okay, so Morrissey is prancing around on stage like a crooner with a giant V-cut shirt with his chest hair just, glistening out as he sings this really stupid song. I'm sorry, John, but maybe in the context of the record, it's more profound, but it's called Kiss Me a Lot, and that's basically what it's about.
Here's the refrain. So kiss me, kiss me, kiss me a lot, kiss me all over my face, kiss me, and then when you're done, kiss me some more. That's the refrain.
Yeah, but I think you did it better than he does it.
Yeah, so that's what the song's about. And so Morrissey sings this with the spotlight on him as his band kind of does their best at playing away and looking cool in the darkness. And every once in a while, it intercuts to a scantily clad woman who may or may not have something written on her.
I think one of them is a famous supermodel, I think.
Maybe, I don't know, but it's super weird. It's the kind of thing that if you were to be watching this and in the presence of another human being that's not necessarily in on the Moz thing, it would be embarrassing that you are watching this. Like, they would question, like, what the fuck are you watching, right? But I don't think Morrissey's a dumb guy, so I think he's completely aware of how this looks. But for whatever Morrissey logic, and that I do not claim to understand, he's like, yes, this is what we need, put it on the internet. So that's what it is, world. John, you're the biggest Morrissey defender I know.
Well, I will defend this in part. Do you like how it opens with the two Italian guys like introducing the video that they made? And they're like, this is the video that we made. Like, it's a high school art project.
It is that moment at the start where you know that there is some level of like self-referential. Like, they're completely aware of what they're doing. But when you're in the video, like when you've gone through the wormhole between like reality and wherever Morrissey lives, and you are minutes into this video and it is the only thing that you know anymore, and it's just happening, and it zooms in and he's got his giant V-cut thing in his shirt and he's singing these Kiss Me lyrics and looking at you as he's singing them, at that moment he seems completely fucking serious.
How about where they green screen him on top of where he would be, so he's like just slightly bigger than he should be in the frame, but because he's green screened, it like makes him look like a giant.
It's fascinating. This whole and then progressively in it, the women that have Kiss Me a Lot, I guess, and lipstick written on them just slowly get more naked because, hey, whatever. And then the end of the video, John. where I don't even know what you call these things. Where the one of the models punches towards the screen, and she has like one of those like knuckle.
Yeah, it's a bracelet. Brass knuckle.
Is it a brass? Yeah, she has brass knuckles on that say Mauser. Right, like this whole project is so aware of what it is, and yet it's not so aware of what it is that it's smirking at you. And that's the fascinating thing. Like, let's say this was a Weezer video. the whole time they'd be like giggling at the camera that they're like, ah, aren't we being stupid, right? But Morrissey is not doing that. He's just being Morrissey, but he is in this stupid scenario. And that is just super weird.
Okay, here's my defense, my partial defense. First of all, I don't know why they picked this as a sing. This is the worst song on the album. The music is actually great, but the refrain is just terrible. Like, I think if they spent 6 hours working on this refrain, they could have made this one of the best songs on the album. But just there is Kiss Me a Lot, Kiss Me. It's just not a good refrain. So it's one of the weaker tracks. The album is fantastic. It's the second best album by far. I think they purposely made this to be like a puzzle, like what are they trying to do here? I mean, the budget is obviously pretty low. I think what they're trying is make it look like one of those music videos from the 70s before there was really music videos, like when they would just like film like things like Live on Top of the Pops or whatever. Like, I think they're trying to make it look like that. Like, go look at some of the music videos by the Damned from the like the late 70s, and it looks a lot like this. I think that's what they were going for, as sort of an homage, if you will, to like British rock shows from the 70s, where they would have bands on or do like music videos just for that show and that show alone. That's what I think they're going for.
I mean, to me, the most fascinating part of this is if anyone wants to go pull this video up, you can find it on Bunk News. Just search for Morrissey. Go and fast forward to about 2:34 into the video or so, where there is a part at the end of a bridge where there's some hand clapping that's going on, and Morrissey, if you pause the video at say 2:35. He has the slightest smirk on his face. Like, he thinks that this is actually pretty funny, but he's trying not to let on that it's pretty funny. And then that smirk vanishes, and he goes into this dramatic, like, alternating left hand, right hand clapping with the music that is just super goofy. And what am I trying to get at here, John?
It's psychedelic.
It's
unsettling.
It's unsettling in that most things that we have to deal with these days that are done for ironic purposes are done incredibly obviously. Like I said, going back to that Weezer thing. Like, if this was a Weezer video, like, you know, there'd be all sorts of goofy shit happening that would be proving to you as you were listening to it that, like, hey everyone, this is funny and ironic, it's okay to watch it, you can laugh along with us, right? This doesn't go that far, and that's why it's so weird.
True, but here's what I want to talk about. But I agree with you 100%. I think that I want to believe that's the puzzle of this. Like, is it terrible, or is it like supposed to be just weird and unsettling? I don't know. But listen, look at Morrissey in this video, and look at the press shot of him just a little bit above, just from a couple of years ago. If you remember, Morrissey claimed, and the reason I say claimed is because everything with this guy is so oblique, he claimed to have had a serious cancer scare. If you look at him in this video, it might be like a terrible makeup job, but he's not looking so healthy in this video. And honestly, Morrissey was putting on the pounds a little bit. He's way skinnier than he's been in a decade or more, you know? I mean, do you guys agree he's not looking so good in this video? He's looking kind of sickly.
He's looking like an old guy, but
yeah, he is looking like he's having a good time, though.
Well, the point is this: to me, like, his face is very skinny, much skinnier than it was just a couple of years ago. So I hope he's not sick. I really do. I just give my best wishes to Morrissey with regards to that. You know what I mean? So,
what I want to know really is the models that had to pose to be in this. Were they fully made aware of the deep and layered forces of Morrissey irony that were involved in this, or did they just show up and just be like, yeah, whatever, sure, right on me?
That's the grand irony of Morrissey. The ladies love Morrissey. And I think the intelligent ladies love Morrissey. So I think because if you remember, one of his earlier promo videos had him reading the lyrics to one of his songs without the music while Pamela Anderson just walked around him in a circle.
Oh, I just watched the end of this video again. I can't believe that they made him. All right, so yeah, so everyone needs a pair of those brass knuckles, and they should just be part of the uniform. We should just be wearing those all the time. Oh God, I don't know what to say about this. It is high art, John. It is.
I like to think it is. And let's talk about the Morrissey of the punk news readership. The guy that represents the best aspect of Morrissey for the punk news fans, Darius Kosky of Swinging Letters. He's now stringing his new album. It's called Sisu. It's already out. It's out via Fat Records. Our writer, Mitch, gave it a 7 out of 10. He digged it. He said, Sisu feels like a true labor of love from Darius Kosky. It is refreshing to see a songwriter so respected in the punk scene have the balls and the talent to branch out in a new ambitious direction and have it sound as authentic and complete as Sisu. Did you guys dig the Swingin' Utters Darius's Sisu?
I did. I haven't listened to it that much, but I'm a huge Swingin' Utters fan, and he is obviously a big part of the songwriting and all that band's about. So, you know, it's pretty cool to hear just him kind of doing it by himself and taking it in some different directions beyond what he's done with them. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
The neat thing about this is that for as old a band as they are, and for as many people like them, I never feel like Swingin' Utters really get their due, at least on punk news. It's funny because like a few weeks ago we talked about Strung Out and how none of us really got Strung Out. And where's the hate mail for that? Did we get hate mail for that?
We didn't. I don't think it's posted yet because we're like 19 weeks behind.
Oh, okay. Well, by the time you guys hear this, we'll have some hate mail because we talked shit on Strung Out. We didn't really talk shit. We just didn't get Strung Out. But like,
I'm going to pause you, Adam. And Adam, you know this. The Strung Out review is basically our most read review of the year. I mean, by like double.
Yeah,
the punk news kids love Strung Out.
They do, and yet I am in the crowd of people who just don't get it.
Yeah, so that's what we expressed on one of the past shows that I guess we're going to at some point get mail about. But Swingin' Utters, they don't, you know, no one talks too much about them yet. So much of the stuff that everyone's beloved punk frontmen are doing these days, all the revival tour stuff, all of the, you know, the kind of folky side projects and stuff like that. Like so much of that stuff has roots in what Swingin' Utters have been doing for years. So, you know, it's interesting then to hear, you know, one of the Utters guys go out and do a solo thing and for have it to sound kind of as complete and interesting, I guess, as this is. Cause like he hits a whole bunch of different genres in this solo thing. It's not just like him with a guitar singing about whiskey. Right, which is what you'd expect from like normally like a punk frontman that's going to go do their own thing. It's going to be him with a guitar and a beard singing about whiskey, and like if anyone would have the right to do that, it would be one of the guys from Swingin' Utters. But here you go, and he's, you know, he's got all kinds of crazy influences on this, and it's a far more fleshed out project. So it's neat. I don't know what point I'm trying to make. It's just that's an observation.
No, but your original point about the Swingin' Utters not getting their due, I agree with. They're like one of my favorite bands of all time. And, you know, people like them and they've been around forever, but I agree. They never seem to really get what I think they deserve.
There's nothing particularly sexy about Swingin' Utters, and maybe that they just needed to sex it up a little bit.
There's nothing sexy about Swingin' Utters. I've seen them live. There's nothing sexy about Swingin' Utters, let me tell you. Speaking of a band that does have the sex appeal, if you will, at least according to Pitchfork, Desaparecidos, which is Conor Oberst's, quote, punk band, which I have issue with, they're going to release a new album. The new album is going to be called, I guess it doesn't have a title. It's going to be out on Epitaph Records. The new single is called City on a Hill, and on the album is going to also be Large and Grace, Tim Casher of Cursive. And, oh, it's called Payola. It's due out June 23, 2014 via Epitaph. Are you guys – well, I'm just going to say it, then I'll let you guys take it. People keep saying, oh, this is Conor Oberst's punk band. I mean, I'm not generally interested in saying what is and what is not punk, but this is not punk. This is just like pop radio rock. The only reason people are saying this is punk is because Bright Eyes is such lightweight music. Like you could play this in Starbucks. If you can play it in Starbucks, it ain't punk. You know what I mean? Except for maybe the Clash. But I mean, like, why do people insist on calling this a punk band? What is punk about this band except for that you could play it next to Coldplay?
They play Patti Smith in Starbucks.
Well, Patti Smith's cool, man. I like Patti Smith. Mm. She's punk.
I have a difficult time with this only because when Conor Oberst and Bright Eyes and you know everyone else that was in Tim Casher and Cursive and all of those bands were doing their thing, that's when Scott was still writing for Punk News, and that was Scott's beat. Like, Scott would be the guy that would talk about the various Midwestern emo bands that were out there. And I could talk about what was going on Hellcat Records, and that was our deal. So this has nothing to do with Rancid. So I'm completely illiterate when it comes to trying to actually, you know, talk about the career of someone like Conor Oberst or Tim Casher or any of those guys. So I'm always ill-equipped to deal with them. I mean, that said, I didn't mind this song, and it's weird because, like, I remember when I was really getting into Titus Andronicus, and a lot of people said, oh, this Titus Andronicus record just kind of sounds like Despacito, whatever.
No way! Right? No way!
A lot of people made that comparison.
No
and,
way!
And, like, listening to this, I'm like, I can... I don't necessarily agree that I'm... because I'm only hearing this song, and I haven't really heard anything else, but I can kind of get where, at least like on like the vocal level or something like that, people are drawing that line, but hey, I mean, so I don't want to hate on this because I listened to it. It was fine.
I saw this band live because everyone said, oh my God, that's a Parasite is coming down. We got to go to Parasite. Snooze fest, baby. I was sorry I didn't stay at home and just like look at my Cro-Mags records, not even listen to them. Just look at them.
Oh God. So I mean, that's the only thing I'm going on for this is that other bands I like, people have compared to this band, but they exist under this, you know, particular circle of the Venn diagram under which I very seldom tread. So I am unsure if I should even bother.
Yeah, I would kind of agree. I'm not really into what they're doing or really what into any of the people in the band have done otherwise. For the new listeners out there, Midwestern emo is not my specialty.
Well, I agree that 100%. And I mean, as always, write us at podcast@punknews.org and tell us how we're wrong. I don't think I'm wrong on this one, but let me know. Let's wrap it up with somebody who is punk rock. It does not get more punk rock than this guy, Jello Biafra. He's putting out two live releases, a 7-inch and an LP, and I guess they're tantalizing releases because they're not exactly the live record everyone wants from Jello, but they're very interesting. As you may know, for the past few years, Jello's traveled down to New Orleans, or Narlins, as they say, during Mardi Gras, and he's done like garage blues and roots covers with some of the guys from Dash Rip Rock, some of the guys from Cowboy Mouth, some of the guy from Mojo Nixon, and Pepper Keenan, as well as Egg Yolk Jubilee and Morning 40 Federation. So basically, he goes down there, they do rough and ragged versions of songs like House of the Rising Sun and A Little May, and you know, basically kind of New Orleans, garage, roots, and Americana music. High energy, very sloppy, very loud. Well, these are finally some of these recordings are finally getting released live. Two songs on a 7-inch, and about, I think, 8 or 10 songs on a 12-inch. The title, as always, Jello is the man, but his titles are sometimes a little too contrived. The album is called A Walk on Jindal's Splinters, I guess referring to Bobby Jindal. But the music looks awesome, I'll tell you. Like, maybe Jello's just too smart for me and I just don't get it. I mean, I know he's political, but the title just seems too anchored in a certain time period for me. But unrelated, I'm excited for this. I think it's going to be awesome. I can't wait to hear this.
I'm looking forward to hearing this. John, your enthusiasm for Jello stuff has I think that proved to me that I really need to go back and to start revisiting his catalog, because I have just been a, you know, a fair weather Jello listener where I'll pop in and out and listen to this or that, but I've not taken the journey, and you've taken the journey.
Jello is kicking ass live. I would say Jello has had two live golden eras. When he played with the Melvins, which they need to release a Jello and the Melvins live record. I don't know why they aren't. Rumors have told me that there are entire live recorded Jelvins recordings that they haven't released. And now with his current band, Guantanamo School of Medicine, Jello is amazing live. Not all the Jello's records are great, especially the ones from the early 90s, but his most recent stuff, of course, Dead Kennedys, and his Jello with the Melvins, like, he's making some of his best music he's ever made. I mean, my favorite Jello record will always be Plastic Surgery for Disasters and Fresh Fruit for Riding Vegetables, but after that, his newest stuff is rivaling or coming at number three after those records. He is on fire lately. On fire.
All right, yeah. Well. We should all be checking this out.
Adam E, man, you down with the Jello?
I am, and honestly, my wife is very down with the Jello. She brought a lot of the harder to find Jello records to the marriage.
Nice. That's a good man. Did you survey your wife's record collection before proposing?
You know, I was gonna write about this in the collector's interview thing, but yes, and my advice to everyone is the best way to increase your record collection is to, you know, as you seek a significant other, survey that collection. If you can fill some holes and, you know, add on.
What do you think of the title of this album, though? A Walk on Jindal's Splinters.
I'm generally against being too specific, because you tend to date yourself. Like 10 years from now, you know, Bobby Jindal, he's going to be a footnote in history. And then it seems kind of quaint.
Yeah, but on the other hand, when it comes to like Jello and the Dead Kennedys stuff, like so much of their stuff has like, you know, direct shout outs to various political figures at the time of the recording in it, that I guess in his case, sure.
Maybe I'm being a hater. Maybe just in my mind, Bobby Jindal isn't like as big to me, as important to me as he's a Jello. I mean, A Walk on Splinters would be cool for a title. You know, A Walk on Jindal Splinters. There seems to be a lot of mental gymnastics you have to go through for that title to make sense. You know what I mean? That's my issue with it.
Yeah, but you see, like if it was like A Walk on Splinters sounds cool, but it sounds cool if you're, say, like Anti-Flag, and you're gonna write like a bunch of, you know, sort of generic protest songs. True. That could be applied at any point. Jello, I want to hear Jello like getting completely riled up about whatever particular issue that he's on, but I want him to be specific. I mean, like, to me, Jello is specific, if anything else.
He is extreme. You don't even have to read the newspaper. You just listen to a Jello song. Speaking of compounding records, Adamy, I know you've got a song for us to keep it rocking while this frat party winds down. The keg is tapped. The Coors Light is all out. We're dripping the last drops from the wine bottles. What can you play us out with as we, you know, lick the bottom of those beer cans and search for the last bit of alcoholic ambrosia?
All right, I'm gonna finish my last Zima then. this song is by a band called Brutal Youth. They're from Canada also. Satan Records is reissuing their debut record called Spill Your Guts on May 12th, you know, getting the whole remaster treatment. The song is called Guts and Black Stuff, so here it is, Brutal Youth, Guts and Black Stuff.
There's blood everywhere, put my heart in the sun, it's dry up, now it's black, I'll put it back in a hole in my chest, what a mess, admit it was stupid, but I never claimed to be clever, and if this, God, I'm a part in this whole fucking mess, if my chest, let it sit in my chest. Instead of bleeding out the drums, but now there's blood fucking everywhere. Don't expect you to clean up this mess with me. Put me late to myself, but I promise we won't have this problem again. I can turn to my face, work with all from just sitting at the thing. Then I'm avoided this whole fucking mess. If I just let it sit in my chest. Instead of bleeding out the drums.
Well, like all good frat parties, it's got to end sometime. It's 4 a.m. You realize, once again, you didn't get to hook up. You're left alone by yourself. Your baseball cap's on backwards. Your pants are sagging. And you're like, another Saturday night, all alone. Well, that's how it's going to be. And that's why I listen to the Punk News Podcast. As always, you can reach that podcast at punknews.org. And we'll see you at next week's Kegger.